I was invited to observe open heart surgery. So I watched a triple bypass in the OR. And the whole goal of today was simply to observe all of the information flow from pre-op, intra-op, post-op, and all the different people, tests, diagnoses, procedures throughout that entire experience. And I have to tell you, you've got me like an hour after I just got out of the OR, finished post-op. One of the best experiences, like I'm still processing it.
The Tech Seeking Human podcast is a podcast about AI developed by humans. We're asking the big questions. Is AI going to cure cancer? Is it going to make our lives better? Will it help us improve our jobs? Or will it eliminate them altogether? Potentially even eliminate humans altogether.
Dave, you and drama, drama, drama.
Well, it's possible. So we set off on a journey to interview some of the brightest minds in the world. TED Talk speakers, thought leaders, keynote speakers, authors, journalists, people like
Max Tegmark, Trisha Wong, Hannah Fry, the list goes on.
See, Max actually thinks that the AI could potentially wipe out the human race.
Well, less than 50%.
Join us for the Tech Seeking Human podcast. Subscribe now. Hit the like button. Hey everyone, nice. Welcome to the Tech Seeking Human podcast. I'm joined by some really cool friends. With me once again is Ellie Brocklehurst up in Singapore, my co-host. How are you, Ellie?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Very good indeed. And joined by Nick King, who is a former colleague of mine, a very good friend, and a very prominent figure in the AI space, hence one of the reasons why he's here. Co-founder. I'm so used to interviewing people that are co-founders. He's the founder of Data Kinetic. Nick, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
Very good. Now, before anyone tries to guess the accent, why don't you just give it up, Nick, and tell us what's going on with your accent?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess now, but originally born in New Zealand, but I've been in the US now for almost 20 years. So if I switch between the two or end up a muddled mess, my apologies, but I will try and communicate as clearly as I can.
Now, we had a pretty good conversation when we started because Ellie and I were talking. Ellie, what did you get up to today?
I dropped my kid off at school. That's the achievement. I've made today. He did cry, so I don't know if it's an achievement.
Well, that's good. So that's a big start to the day. And I played with my RoboVac. Now it can't get back to the dock, which is not unusual for a RoboVac. Nick, on the other hand, did something far more interesting. Nick, do you want to share with us what you got up to today?
Yeah, so I'm currently in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I was invited to observe open heart surgery. So I watched a triple bypass in the OR, and the whole goal of today was simply to observe all of the information flow from pre-op, intra-op, post-op, and all the different people, tests, diagnoses, procedures throughout that entire experience. And I have to tell you, you've got me like an hour after I just got out of the OR, finished post-op. One of the best experiences, like I'm still processing it, but the skill involved to do open heart surgery is mind blowing. And so I was with Dr. Zane Kelpy, who I think you know, amazing, amazing heart surgeon and a pioneer in lots of different dimensions. And so it was a real privilege to do this. So unfortunately, no kids dropped off today over here in Scottsdale, but I did manage to participate in open heart surgery. So it was a day.
Did the operation go successfully?
It did. You know, the interesting thing about it, like all the research that we've done around medical records and everything else always assumes a time scale, right? So we kind of get like reports before the procedure, we get reports during the procedure, you get reports afterwards. That's what we see the data. But what was so interesting is really that's not how surgery really works. You kind of have these control points, or like think of them as like, first the person has to be obviously, put to sleep for a bit. Then you have to gradually open up and harvest different veins. That's a different step. And there's different ways of assessing if that's good or bad. And you've got to have the right veins to use to do the bypass. Then you have to open them up, which is something else. That's a whole procedure. And then there's, heart lung machines. So the heart actually stops, which is one of the craziest things to ever see. Then the bypasses are done. And so there's a whole bunch of understanding the geometry of the heart, which you would never really understand from reading like a health record, but how the heart's positioned and everything around it's really important. And then you have to put it all back together again. So incredibly fascinating just watching the difference between, you know, the data we would process from an AI standpoint and then the actual procedure. So I had probably like about 4 or 5 pages of notes of just what's not captured in your health data, in the health record that happens in the OR as these people are saving lives.
Yeah, I was going to say, because Nick, I don't remember you graduating from medical school. So I was intrigued as to how you knew all these things, but naturally you're there for data purposes. Is that correct?
Yeah. So part of the way that healthcare works, it's so fascinating. Like these professionals, they study for, you know, sometimes decades, you know, like Dr. Kalpi's doing 400 patients a year. And there's so many places that data lives. There's, you know, you've seen the different, you know, the waveforms of your heart, and there's scans you do of the heart, and there's actual electrocardiogram tests and contrast tests. And what's really interesting from the data perspective is that none of the data is actually all amalgamated at one point in time. Like each specialist will pull parts of the data and provide back results, or, you know, like someone like Zane will actually assess all these different pieces, and throughout the day he is going through and making decisions based on all of this information at one point in time. So the informatics of this healthcare. And one of the things we've been trying to capture is it possible for us to detect AF, which is when the heart stops, or predict when it may happen post-surgery? And the other piece is how we think about how the state, so think of the state of a patient being like how they're actually feeling, doing, recovering at a point in time is actually maintained. Because usually a doctor will assess state when they go and see that patient. And so that state often actually lives in the hallways, which is why AI will never replace doctors or nurses, because they're the ones that actually know if the patient is looking better or feeling better or moving better. And so it's really interesting from an AI perspective for us to figure out, okay, how do we recognize the data gaps, sort of the implicit and explicit things that happen around the data. And so that was really what a big part of today was to try and understand, okay, how do we process this much data? How do we make sense of it? And how do we do so in a responsible way? And those are, you know, there's so many questions that come from just those 3 or 4 statements.
I have 2 questions. So is the idea that it would also, being able to assess all those little data points, be able to then create a faster way to assess the trigger points, or like, or when things become dangerous, because you've now got so much more data captured that you'd be able to predict if patients are going to code or whatever. I don't know what the word is. I'm no medical professional. Is that kind of also the idea of your involvement today?
Yeah, let's look at my own health as an example, right? So like, I know my current blood pressure, I know what my heart rate is, I know all those data points, and those data points follow me around, right? But then there's also like, how am I feeling today? How am I looking? Like, if, you know, some days you can go for a 2-mile run, some days you can barely run around the block. Why is that? You know? And so what we want to look at is how do we capture all of these elements in a way that's able to be measured and interpreted by a practitioner. So you always want a human over the loop. But then, you know, how I felt 6 months ago could be very relevant to how I'm feeling today, right? I may have changed my diet and, you know, suddenly I'm allergic to kale, which ironically is the only thing I'm allergic to is kale, which I celebrate often. But
did you say kale?
Yeah, it's an achievement. I'm very proud of it.
Oh, I thought you were saying cow. Like,
kale. Yeah, I know, kale.
No, allergic to kale,
the green vegetable you really tell you is healthy. Yeah, so
isn't that only going into quiches anyway? Like, what should kale be going to?
Should be going into nothing. Is
yeah, okay, well, but
you know, so imagine if you change your diet. So the concept of lineage of like what may have changed is really important. And so if you think about a cardiac event, you know, all the stuff that happened before it could be very relevant or completely irrelevant. And so, you know, we look at sort of a point in time as of our health, But there's so many factors that surround how we feel and what happens that really the goal is to begin to understand, okay, can we capture more of that information? And the reason for wanting to understand that is that it allows us to then begin to run other scenarios. Like, okay, what happens post-surgery? Was this person lucky to recover? So we look at things like frailty. Is this patient frail? Like, that makes total sense, right? Like, how can they get up and walk 5 meters in under 5 seconds is kind of a general test. The pectoral muscle depth is also another good indicator, which makes total sense, because if I can lift things up and put them down and I've been active, I'm going to have a thicker pectoral muscle. And so you want to have all these different factors that surround my health. Now, if my pectoral muscle a year ago was in good shape and today it's not, suddenly there's been an effect in my health. And so that's part of the sort of, I guess, the research that we're going through right now is it possible for us to get a more complete picture of someone's health spectrum? And then over a period of time, also understand a health spectrum. Does that give us insights? It means we can ask other questions to help intervene or prevent potential things down the line. Like, recovery is pretty traumatic. These are, you know, pretty invasive surgeries. And so, you know, those first 5 days after surgery are really important. And if you can reduce the likelihood of AF, which is when the heart stops, then, you know, they'll spend less time in ICU. They're more likely to start moving around faster, which is also a good indicator of getting, you know, moving around, less likely to be readmitted, gains more strength, et cetera. So that's really the mission at this point is, how do we accurately capture the breadth of, you know, the state and the information that surrounds an individual? And then secondary, how do you then use mathematical models to represent and interpret that? And I want to be careful with the word interpret. So one thing in applied AI, which is kind of the discipline we focus on, is we genuinely, almost in no case, do we actually create data or let like ChatGPT fill in the answer. Instead, what we do is we take the actual statistics and we use a large language model to organize that data in a particular format or arrangement that allows us to pass it or then enrich it with other models or other tests that allow us to build that. We've all heard of hallucinations, and those are not good things, particularly if they're talking about your health. You don't want an AI robot deciding you need to have triple bypass surgery when all you need is an aspirin. And so that is in order to make all that possible, you have to first start with deeply understanding, you know, not just the data that's captured, but the data that's implicitly captured around that situation. So that was really a big part of today's learning, I think, was just seeing that workflow, you know, understanding everything that goes into it. And yeah, it's I would say you're like 50% of the data is captured in a way today that, you know, lots of stats are captured, but just the skill and the teamwork and the way that these healthcare professionals work, you know, just this is mind blowing.
Can I ask, Nick, so if you do predict that the chest muscle has an impact, the pectorals have an impact over heart attack and heart risk factors, please let me know, because I've really been neglecting chest and back and been focused on the beach muscles, which is biceps and triceps and a bit of shoulders. But in all seriousness, the data points are super interesting to me because, as you know, I've got a HRV status, blood pressure, I'm doing the same thing, or Apple Watch, you know. But if you think about a hospital and the conversations that we had before, like your medical records are often scribbled down by doctors that learned to scribble before they learned to write. And like classifying this data and getting it into a format that would make it readable has to be the first challenge, I would imagine. Data privacy would have to be another massive one, because we often have this debate that it's like, maybe the reason we haven't progressed anything in medical terms with AI is because everyone's paranoid, but like, what if we could prevent heart attack? What if that was the vision? What if that was the goal? Wouldn't everyone go, okay, I'm all right for you to take my data and analyze it and try to figure these things out? I'm just sort of wondering, the biggest challenge, and you said like only 50% of the data is being analyzed right now. For those listening, I really want them to get a sense of like, how far progressed are we in applied AI for medicine purposes like this? Is this like really pioneering early days?
Yeah, it depends where you set the vision, right? So I think there's so much opportunity for us in this space. Just even rather than trying to create one masterful AI that solves all healthcare problems, I actually don't believe that's the right way to solve it. What I do think is, and this is a term that I think we'll hear a lot more of in the coming year, which is we talk about compounding AI or compound AI models. And so you end up with a highly tuned AI function that's very good at just predicting, you know, the relationship of gait, movement, and pectoral muscle depth with calculating a frailty score. Or readmission for patients over 70 that have a certain social determination of health. And so, you know, I think we need to really focus on these very specific agent-driven functions that all begin to work together based on what it's seen. And I think number two, your answer, your question on privacy, like people should have the right to choose what happens with their information. That is their right. And so I'm not a proponent of everyone should upload their data to some central database. I think, yes, could we learn stuff from that? Absolutely. Could it be used in good or bad terms? Yeah, it could be used in lots of ways, and people should have the right to choose what they do with their healthcare data. I think that's the most important piece, and have the then expect their healthcare data to be remain secure and, you know, confidential. And I think that's a liberty that, you know, we should expect. Now, that also adds complexity to how we build these AI models, right? Like farming something off to this, you know, cloud AI that magically consumes all your data and does something with it, probably isn't the right way to ensure that you've maintained people's liberty for the right to choose what happens with their healthcare data. But when you work with a healthcare provider, you kind of want all of their services, all of their different skills, and all those people that make up that healthcare ecosystem that you're part of to be able to help you. And so, you know, generally that's sort of when you sign those forms. I don't know if you sign them in Australia, but I'm sure in the US we sign like 30 forms whenever we go, you know, get a basic checkup. Those forms are saying, this is my healthcare provider. I want them to access my healthcare records. And so I think that informed consent of, I want the people looking after me to know, and I want to know that that's as far as that it goes, is a good starting point. So we've built out models effectively to run that type of isolation. And so it does require foundational, it does require transfer learning. But I think that we are getting to a point where these models are able to transfer, learn a significant amount, and then build up the skills that exist inside of that, you know, healthcare ecosystem you're a part of.
So the vision is clear. Like, if we can apply AI to minimize heart attacks, to improve healthcare, you know, the suffering that's caused from cancers and whatnot, if we expand it even beyond the heart to so many other different medical things, it's a massive challenge to undertake, but I think the reward is significant. What's the business model? Who's paying for this? Ultimately, someone is going to need to want to pay in order to fund what it is that you're doing, and I assume you're not doing it because you're just a really great guy from New Zealand.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think the important thing is to stay grounded. So yeah, sometimes
well,
it's
the
about,
New Zealand
it's about,
part will help with that.
Yeah, and so there's an element here of like, you've got to sometimes solve the really what seem like simple problems. So let's take some like ER room capacity forecasting. We all know of or have heard that nurses post COVID have a huge burnout rate. It's a very stressful job. There's been a huge amount of trauma that's associated with, you know, what was a really complex time for a lot of people. And so, you know, you want to make sure that those emergency rooms are staffed appropriately. And what I think a lot of folks don't realize is that there are specialty nurses. So there's different types of nurses that handle different types of activities. And there are a lot of things that can affect things. So we know that 4th of July is going to be a busy day, just like Guy Fawkes in Australia. I'm not sure what day in Singapore, but, you know, there's a day when people will tend to do sillier things than they normally would. So that's one. Then you want to look at, okay, is there like a strain of influenza? So how do you start to understand what's happening in your like local health ecosystem? And so something as simple as forecasting an emergency room inflow becomes a really important model. If you think about all the complexities exist in that, just by making sure that the staff is appropriately staffed, reduces burnout, but also ensures that the providers themselves can, you know, optimize for that, reduce staff turnover, but also, you know, ensure the highest possible standard of care, which is what they all strive for. And so the starting point is solving problems that we all probably think, like, well, does this just build a roster? And but that's getting more accurate there is a great place to start. And then the secondary is like, okay, let's predict the length of stay. So how long do we think a patient should stay in hospital? Well, you want them to stay at hospital as long as they enter to be absolutely healthy. But you also want them to not stay at hospital too long so they don't, you know, get unhealthier from not being mobile. So there's like a really fine line about how you design that care plan that goes along with it. So to start with, we're really focusing on things like the social determinants of health, which is like if you're in a neighborhood that might not be as higher up the social economic status, it may have less access to care, it might be a rural area, you may, you know, come from a family of smokers. There could be a number of things that could be determining your health that could all go into really changing the experience of those people. So that's where we start. And then I think longer term, we start to look at how payers and providers and practitioners all come together to find sort of an optimal outcome. Because we all want to be happy and healthy. Everyone wants that. Doctors want that. You want that. Even insurance people want that, right? Everyone wants you to be happy and healthy. So we're actually all aligned in these goals. So a lot of it is, okay, how do we ensure that we do that in the most efficient way possible? I think everyone can agree that happy, healthy people really efficiently and happier and healthier is a good thing. And so that's generally where we try and sit.
I've got to ask this question, though. You're right. Healthcare providers do want people to be healthy, especially countries that have a really high cost of medicine, of applying medicine, like Medicare in Australia, like Singapore. US is really more than anything. It's like almost a bit more pay as you go, right? Why is it not being run out of the countries like the UK that their national health services costs an absolute fortune? This would be like ideal. It's almost like you're developing it in a country that isn't the one that needs it the most.
Yeah, I think everyone needs it. Everyone deserves to be happy and healthy. I think each system has its own intricacies, right? So, you know, let's take the NHS and you know, I'd even put work and pensions as part of that. You know, they have a phenomenal opportunity as, you know, state-managed public health systems to do a lot of great things, and they do. And, you know, one of the challenges the NHS faces is actually just that, the scheduling. There's big backlogs in scheduling. And so, you know, I think I was just in Dubai, and I was just in Riyadh in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And, you know, I think there is a real global recognition that, you know, there has to be a way of helping reach more people and support them. Now, the US is absolutely, you know, a complicated market. But it also, because of the way that it works, it also has a lot more access to a lot more treatments and a lot more specialization. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think what we can often find in the US is you know, we can specialize on specializations just themselves and get, you know, really high fidelity. And it's also proximity, right? I live in Texas. You know, I'm right down from a number of very, you know, deep research, amazing universities, UT. We've got Rice down there. They're just, you know, everyone recognizes the opportunity.
And it's innovation too, right? Because like Dr. Zane Kelby is a renowned heart surgeon that also happens to be a tech guy that believes that this is the future. And it takes someone to have a vision to execute on, to bring someone like you into the mix so you can be part of this conversation so you can start running models and you can prove out the value.
Yeah, you know, I found that with healthcare practitioners, they're so willing and wanting to work with us. You know, they all got into it for their own reasons, but generally they generally align with like, okay, there's got to be a better way. Now, there are definitely organizational challenges, which I think is worth like everything. We could go look at a library and we'd have organizational challenges, right? The thing is like you've also got to remember that in applied AI, we're not trying to give everyone another iPad or another chatbot or a co-pilot. You know, sometimes the best application of AI is to never even see that AI as it works, right? Is to simply be able to bring together those records in a way that's powerful, that can be accessed, simply have a way of managing state between different practitioners. And I think sometimes we, us nerds, or at least me as a nerd, we want to build this app, right? It solves all these problems. We're like, oh, we'll just put a wrap around it. And like, yes, that's easy to understand what's got a wrap around it. But that doesn't necessarily help the end goal. It feels good because you can point at something, but it doesn't necessarily always mean that it shifted the experience differently. And so another reason for today, I can tell you that no one had an iPad up carrying medical notes. There were lots of screens, there's lots of systems, there's whiteboards, there's, you know, this is a very high-end, you know, sophisticated hospital with the robots and all the stuff you'd imagine in a high-end hospital. But, you know, I don't think anyone would have a hand free to have an app in their hand at the same time. And, you know, I think that's the opportunity as well, and what maybe makes this complicated is that you have to also be aware of those workflows these people live in day in, day out. You know, and I think that's one area in applied AI. You have to understand the behaviors you're working with and the way that people want to sort of take action from those behaviors is also super critical.
Just going back to what Dave asked about why the US was the market is, and I'm putting this more of like a consumer lens on my head because I feel like we're talking very much organizational, and there's a lot of, I can see a lot of elements to government and companies and insurance companies and the benefits. But I like the idea that US is a market because US is like one of the most costly places to have medicine, and you don't have a Medicare equivalent. So actually, a lot of the communities can't even afford Medicare. So this is a way to obviously decrease spending, right? So if you're not spending so much, you know, if you're like, oh, look, I have to take time off work. I know that I'll only be in there probably 3 days as opposed to six that they told me. Like I see there's a way that makes this a bit more affordable, particularly for a market like America where it is so unaffordable.
Yeah, I think, right? You know, in the US, you know, there's actually pretty good healthcare coverage. Like Obamacare did a pretty good job of driving up healthcare coverage. CMS and HHS do an amazing job of community health. So, you know, I think we look at other areas of, you know, healthcare where there perhaps isn't the coverage that we'd like to see. So think of someone in a rural area, right? Like there used to be this concept of a rural doctor. Like in Australia, you have like, you know, the flying doctor service, yeah. And you have rural doctors. Well, those doctors have all moved to the cities, right? So you tend to have a lower quality of care as you're further out. And so a lot of the programs that, you know, we look at where AI can really help is, okay, how do you reach these patients? You know, how do you ensure things like flu vaccination or COVID vaccination or care plans for diabetes are in place? And I think you're right in the fact that as an individual, you want to be able to access care. You want to have the choice to access care. And maybe it's not being as accessible as you know we would have liked it to have been, but I do think that there are programs in place. The numbers are astounding. Like, you know, the numbers are crikey numbers. Like, I think the U.S. healthcare market is $4 trillion all a year, and that gives you an idea of the number of bees when you get to thousands of bees. So it's a significant market.
I laughed out loud because I got stung in the face by a bee a few weeks ago. So I know what it's like, and I had to go to the ER, actually. I had to go to the emergency department because my face swelled up. I will put this over the video just for all of us to have a big laugh so we can all pretend that we just saw my face that looked like Bert Newton, if you know who Bert Newton was, but he was a great man and had a massive head. I had to go to hospital as a result. This is very ironic that you mentioned bees, but you should continue if you can remember where you're at.
Well, I'm glad you recovered. And no more elephantitis is going on there, so that's good. But, you know, I think to your question, can it reduce costs? I think the answer is yes. But the cost of healthcare globally will continue to go up. And look, I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to make it more efficient. I think also there's a better awareness of people what it takes to be healthy. And so, you know, again, I'll say pick on my own self. Like, you know, after working in this space, I became much more conscious of my own health records and managing my own elements and making sure, you know, things make a difference that you can actually change. And you want to not be to the point where you're having to be dragged in to an ER knowing you're sick. And I think that, you know, shifting perceptions on how we can manage our own health. You know, the obvious things. Don't eat a burger and fries and a milkshake every night for dinner, right? Makes a big difference. You know, something as simple as walking a mile a day or a kilometer a day can have a substantial impact on your health. So, you know, where I also hope to see these types of things help is that you go in for your checkup and you get a care plan, which gives you, like, you know, hey, here's your care plan. Like, okay, we know you feel comfortable walk a kilometer, now get to two. You know, you were eating X calories, try to get it down to a lot. And I think that is where, you know, we as individuals can also take some responsibility and navigate it. Because I can promise you that, unfortunately, deferred pain is a very easy thing to not worry about, but you know, you don't want to be at 65, 70 and suddenly having to, like, you know, crash diet and everything else when in your 40s you could have been, you know, on top of it. And so I do think that that is a huge opportunity just for our own personal understanding and the access to that understanding. And, you know, go ahead.
Sorry. No, Dave and I, we covered this in another podcast episode where we unpack, like, future trends that are going to hit this year. And one of them is this, very much, is that there's a real appetite among people to be more in control of their own health. And mental health plays a component of that. But there's also the physical health side. So there's definitely, and I don't know if it's maybe because of COVID, we became so much more aware of our own physical, emotional capacity that there's kind of been this real drive towards trying to be healthier and better. And it's, I mean, it's an awesome drive. Like, I live in Singapore, which is incredibly humid and incredibly hot all year round. And even just since COVID, witnessing how many more people run, how many more gyms have been created, like how many more health centers there are, and even the mental health is being taken so much more seriously. It's a real thing. It's awesome.
The marathons are all sold out, which is devastating for me because I really wanted to get in the marathon. But now I'm like, well, I'll just have to do the half. What a shame. but there are, you're right, you're spot on. Like, more people are running. As you were talking, Nick, I was thinking about, like, the biggest challenge is food. Like, they often say, like, to lose weight and to maintain your health, it's like what you put into your body, whether it's alcohol, food, like whatever you're putting in. And I just don't know that we've got – there are apps. Like, I've used some apps before, MyFitnessPal and things like that, that'll calculate things, but it's more just for weight loss, not actually personalizing the types of food that I should eat and even forecasting. Like, I love the idea, and I had this conversation with someone yesterday and they were just struggling to get motivated and to get fit. And I said, it's really simple. If you keep putting more calories into your body and less output, this is the trajectory, Tevye. You'll have more health problems and you'll be able to run. It'll be harder to run. It's like this AI could actually forecast, based on the diet you're eating, where you'll be, and it could be in an ER.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, so here's the thing, like, you know, everyone has unique bodies. I think you're right. Calories in versus calories is a simple formula. And if that's not working, something might also be wrong. But I think also, we're also becoming much more familiar with what will help us live longer. And, like, how, like, I think people born 20 years from now will live to 120, no problem. Right? Like, I recently had a friend diagnosed with leukemia. 4 weeks later, took a pill. Now he doesn't have leukemia. 10 years ago, he would have been, you know, I would have been visiting him in a hospital. So, like, the medicine has come a huge way. So now if we're living longer, things like, you know, drinking beers, you know, every Friday night for 20 years will have a massive effect on, like, joint health and other things that potentially we may not have had before because we, you know, weren't able to get through these other chronic conditions. So another space, like we talked about, you know, just understanding your current position, another space I find really fascinating is, okay, what if we start to understand what it would take for us 30 years from now, or 40 years from now, to be our much healthier self?
Right.
And, you know, that is research all the time. There's a deeper understanding of our genetics. You know, if we look out where, you know, you sort of ask, where could this go? What would be phenomenal is if you could start to understand, okay, you know, at 25 years old, maybe I could have removed cal from my diet and not had implications later on. Now, you know, I'm sort of tongue-in-cheek about kale, but like, there's lots of things that you could start to be more aware of, or maybe supplements that could support that. And so I think we are heading to a point of really personalized healthcare. Now, that would be phenomenal, right? You know, heart health and other elements could be addressed in your early 20s versus, you know, your mid to late 30s. And that has significant impacts on people's ability to have kids, ability to stay healthy. And that's all hyper-personalized. So I think, you know, we're a long way from this, you know, and I think healthcare professionals are, as I said, that continue to amaze you with all they know. But if we can just help support with a little bit more information each time and each get a little, compound these AI impacts, maybe in 10 years time, maybe a doctor has enough information to be able to prescribe a specifically personalized care plan just for you. And
can
maybe
I ask a really cynical question?
Mm-hmm.
You might not get a good answer,
I'll
but you can
you
ask
context.
It.
I'm going to give you the context. So I have had two melanomas. One was an in situ and then one was a stage or level two. So, you know, and once I get level three, we all know it's not a good diagnosis. So I'm very, very conscious of the fact that in future, I'm definitely going to get more. And so I get scanned. I was warned by a doctor to not get any genetic testing because they were like, you get genetic testing and it will show, if it shows any indicators that it's in your genetic makeup, insurance covers and will never cover you. What's to say that this kind of technology doesn't get, I don't know, somewhat like manipulated by the insurance industry to be able to then predict that if you've got triggers within your genetic makeup, that you may likely end up with something further down the line. What's to say they don't use this as a way to prevent coverage?
Yeah, well, okay, so this is a very deep ethical
question.
Conversation, but let's play with it. So in the US, it's actually now illegal to not cover someone for a pre-existing condition. So, you know,
really?
There are certain, and under Obamacare, there are some provisions that matter. Like, basically, it's a mutually assured destruction if you don't cover pre-existing conditions that, you know, that Medicare agreement will break down. Now, you know, is it possible to start to manage, like, how do you look at the risk equation of the cost of someone's healthcare over their lifetime? Potentially, yes. Statistically, you could do that. Now, a good payer would build that into their models and understand that, you know, in your 30s and 40s, you may discover it, and then later in life, and usually we tend to switch payers in the US. Like, it's very rare that you'll be with the same insurance company your entire life. With state-run healthcare, you know, they also will have a dollar associated with you for your entire life. And then usually what happens in public healthcare systems is we also supplement with private insurance. It's very common to have like base public healthcare and then private on top. And so sometimes those private insurance that are all going to your public system will do that. But in theory, the public health system is in place to sort of cover that. So is it possible? Yes. Statistically, should they do it? Probably. And you're probably asking why probably. Well, then what's to put in place those that have that genetic disposition to not have earlier screening? right? So I've had melanomas removed. We all probably grew up under a great big ozone hole in the 90s, which is probably why we all experienced that. It's gone now, by the way, which is quite good. But the negative side of it is that, you know, most of us down under have had, you know, too much time in the sun. That's what we did. And then so we were exposed to it. MoLMAT also was pioneered in New Zealand and Australia. And so there are preventative
measures. Love MoLMAT.
So I do think, is there a risk there? Yes. What?
Me too. I like MoLMAT, but I haven't done the same, and I've had a melanoma replaced. I'll agree.
Replaced.
Yeah.
Replaced. So I think removed. Probably. Hence why the insurance company isn't interested in me. No, I'm only kidding. Keep going.
But I think the question is, if you're able to predict health conditions for a community further forward, would you A, choose to do nothing and decline coverage, or B, choose to do something and prevent it?
Yep.
And I genuinely believe people, just situations don't always land, you know, as they were expected. And so there's got to be mechanisms to kind of do that. And generally it comes down to the actual doctor that ends up helping us out, right? They want us healthy. So long story short is, like, yes, there is risk for it, but I think ultimately over time it does normalize. And then again, where I said, like, you have the liberty to control your own healthcare data, that's a decision you get to make. And that's why I'm not a fan of, like, an AI to rule the world that we all just upload our genetic data. And there's movies written about this. Probably doesn't, actually. And I think it is that whole, you know, preemptive, you know, exclusion is something that, at least in the US, we actively work against and make sure we don't make happen. And we're actually working in solid for that.
I think this is awesome. Like, and I did a podcast previously on another podcast with Foxo Technologies that do DNA genetic sequencing, and it was super interesting. And one of the challenges actually for them was the insurance companies were the one leading it because they really wanted to understand and they had proper reasons for wanting to do that, but people didn't want to know the answers. And that's often an issue just even as we start progressing this AI, is that some people just don't want to know what's going on, and that's something we should probably really try and overcome.
Yeah, that's their choice. The right choice, that's their prerogative. It's like, you know, smoking's not good for you, but it feels pretty good to have with a coffee when you sort of start the day. I mean, you know, so there's this element of, like, you know, what's the trend off of quality of life? There's that guy that's, you know, trying to live forever. And I saw him on a podcast last week. He looks sick. I'm like, dude, you live forever, but you look terrible. And so there's like a balance of, like, what makes a healthy lifestyle for the individual.
I was just going to say highly personalized. It's
your choice.
It's going to be different for everyone. I think Ellie's looks like she's going to get in trouble because she's in Singapore. And this is a massive topic that we continue to unpack, but Ellie's stay in the studio is coming to an end, and she can't put any more coins in the machine and pull the thing down to extend it because they don't do that stuff in Singapore. They, like, literally eject you from building and potentially the city, and her kids won't be able to go to school. So there's very serious consequences if Ellie doesn't get out of the studio. But Ellie, does that mean you have to leave now and I'll ask Nick a couple more questions or...
Yeah, I did. I just silently packed around me like it's a completely empty desk where I'm sitting.
It wasn't that silent, but that's okay. That's because you've got that microphone, not the one that I told you to get.
I pressed the mute button on it.
Okay. We still heard it, but that's okay.
I'm so sorry.
After the fact, or everyone can just listen to how much fun it was to hear Ellie pack up. She's like, I'm done with this topic. AI and the future of healthcare is so irrelevant to me. I'm young.
No,
I'm
love
fit,
it.
Got some melanomas, but I'll be fine. Like,
my biggest takeaway from this is that I even though I did ask a very simple question, I totally believe in it, and I think you're right. I think if my choice was to not divulge that information and run the risk, or to divulge the information and maybe find out what's coming down the line, I definitely take this side. I'm very conscious that living a healthy life means living a happy life, and so any way I can be healthy, anyone that can help me be healthy, I'm totally on board with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to ask Nick a couple more questions, so you can stay or go wherever you see fit. Just try not to smash the place when you leave.
I'm so conscious I don't even want a present button.
It's not going to break. Just make sure the audio quality, just for everyone recording, we're using Riverside, which is, we're not sponsored by them, but when Ellie, when you finish, you need to wait and it then uploads fully. So just make sure you're fully uploaded.
I'm just
going to
step outside. So I'll just mute my camera. I'll mute my microphone. And I'm just going to listen because I'm really enjoying this. But thank you so much, okay. Nick. It was a real pleasure to meet you.
Love it. Thank you.
So Nick, one other question I got for you. We've only touched on healthcare. There are so many other industries when it comes to AI, but I wanted to talk about your data kinetic situation. It seems to me like most people assume you could apply an AI and they just don't understand it. They don't just like, they go like you're saying, you can't just have this one AI for this entire cloud and you just go, here you go, here's a, go AI, go figure out how to cure celiacs, go like get rid of diabetes now, like we've given you all the data, go figure it out. It doesn't work like that. And I think what you're picking up on, which I think is interesting, and I wonder if this is your point of difference, is applying a high level of customization and your own ability and your own skill to really break this problem down and start to chip away at it.
Yeah, I think I've worked in building platforms for, you know, 2 decades now and got really good at selling platforms. And these platforms are amazing what they're possible of doing. But I would often, you know, sell a platform to a large company and then they'd be like, okay, cool, I've got this platform, now what? And then they'd go work with, you know, big consultants and, you know, engineers and build it. And that would usually take, you know, another 2 years. And what I realized was that, you know, in those conversations, you know, when we're building these very large systems, often we're really selling the outcome. The platform was a means to the end. And so what the area of research and applied we focus on is how do you deliver a consistent outcome? What does that look like? And so it turns out when you see enough AI problems, there are building blocks, those components I talked about, which are highly repeatable. And there's an architecture that allows us to begin to approach it. And it's very different to the AI architectures of the past. So, you know, we're all familiar with GPT-4. GPT-4 is a mixture of expert models. From what we can tell, there's 18 or 19 of them. There's all sorts of caching and model routing and everything else that goes on. So it allows these mixture of experts that allows you to kind of choose, the model chooses which one to respond and gives you the most likely best response. But what if you could instead build up, you know, agents, and think of ChatGPT, like the chat function is technically an agent that's connected to stuff. What if you had an agent that's its only job was to predict, you know, the failure of a certain seal in an oil rig? And whenever, you know, something happened on that oil rig, you know, it would send and broadcast the message to this AI, and the AI would know to send those particular signals to that SEAL agent, which would then respond back with, here are some things to check. And honestly, it's not as English as it sounds. It'd usually be like JSON or a symbolic language. And so two things happen is that it's very hard to trace and understand how a large language model makes a decision. So when you start to think about an agent-driven approach across these compounding AI models, what you can see is you actually can see the reaction of the specific AI function as it, you know, works with it either collaborate with other agents or it can work on its own. And so you have much more of a systematic approach to how you scale it. And so a lot of the thesis for us at Daycare is, you know, yes, large language models are very good at, you know, organizing and assembling information, recalling things and being fine-tuned. But what if you could almost have a collaboration of a series of highly specialized agents and models? And sometimes they're just math models, they're just physics models. Sometimes they're lookups of data. Sometimes they are, you know, a neural network or some level of deep learning to respond back. And that's really been our thesis, which was, could we build these blueprints that allowed us to get to the 80% of most problems and then solve the last 20% with the customer?
Okay.
And you and I both know the secret of most AI companies, which is that last 20% is usually being done by those AI companies under the guise of customer success or something else.
Mm-hmm.
So very rarely do you have an AI platform that magically gives you the answer when you put it into your enterprise system. So that's really where we focus in that thesis. It's allowed us to really focus in a couple of areas. Healthcare is the one we spoke about a bunch today. But oil and gas and energy has been the other area we're really focused in on. And the other one is climate transformation. And you're probably wondering how we ended up in those three. Turns out that, you know, pipes and valves and moving oil around is not too dissimilar to moving blood around. And it turns out that when we look at climate transformation, there's a lot of opportunity in how we think about, you know, how energy is transmitted, how energy is, how these things all work together. And they all require these complex, auditable, regulated spaces for us to work in. So that's where we ended up. It's not the easiest place to start, trust me. It would be nicer to start in retail and do churn models, but these problems seem like they would be impactful, and you know, we could, you know, with enough work and effort and you know, focus, I think we can really make a difference.
I was just going to say that, like, yeah, you're picking. This isn't like, yeah, churn analysis and how to get customers and how to predict whether people are going to return the two t-shirts and ruin the environment. It's more like you've gone, okay, well, there's the planet. We need to kind of make sure that that's okay. And we don't know as much as what we know about it, but we could apply AI to try and understand that. And then there's the energy for all of us to do what we need to do on the planet. And then there's the people that are running around on the planet. And so it's like you're tackling like probably three of the biggest topics that are monumental. The clue was that you're in Saudi Arabia. That's where I sort of picked up the oil and gas linkage. Yeah. I went, I wonder what he's doing there. Probably not the Formula One. But probably something to do with oil and gas.
You know, ironically, for in KSA, about 70% of that trip was healthcare. 30% was absolutely oil and gas, but 70% was healthcare. It's amazing what they're doing there. But, you know, on the energy side, you know, we all can agree that we want, you know, a cleaner environment, less carbons in the atmosphere, but we need more energy, you know, and how we think about, every of us, I call it climate transformation versus climate change or ESG, and it's a very deliberate sort of way of articulating it, because why would we not transform the way we do business to be better for, you know, the climate, for our people, for everything? But I don't think it's about turning off, you know, oil wells and eating bugs. I think it's about getting use
all
of
kale.
Yeah, all kale. It's much more about, okay, we need hydrocarbons for plastics, for pharmaceuticals, for many, many, many things.
Yep.
And so you want to get those out of the ground in the best possible way, and you want to make sure that, you know, you expel as few carbons, or methanes, or other hydrocarbons in the atmosphere which have that impact. But, you know, at the same time, we need to 10x the amount of energy we have. We can't reduce the amount of footprint. Like, it's you know, I used to have, you know, work in the Congo and actually looking at how we get these rare earth minerals out of the Congo. And I can tell you that is the supply chain from, you know, cobalt in the Congo to your cell phone is terrifying. And so, you know, in some ways, there's a balance there of like, what, how do you transform, you know, how a supply chain works to be healthier and better? And how do you provide energy? You know, if everyone has the internet and everyone has power, it's a better place. And so I think, you know, that's really where I think a lot of executives are also starting to have this, you know, they don't just want to slap a sticker on and say they're carbon neutral. Like, you know, it will be a competitive advantage to be able to 10x their efficiency and 10x their delivery and do so in a 10x better way of driving that outcome. And so that's, you know, really is where we gravitate towards, these highly regulated, highly complex scenarios that allow us to apply this sort of agent AI approach. And, you know, I think healthcare is definitely in the lead right now, just because we've been able to find so many interesting use cases. And I think it's so clear, you know, the beginning and the end. Energy, you know, I think they're coming, they get a really rough time, and sometimes they should, sometimes they shouldn't. But I think there is real consensus across that sector to do better and achieve more. And I actually think out of all of the different industries, they're probably the most equipped to do that, both from the amount of capital they have, but also the ability for them to deploy technology and manage regulations and so forth. So, you know, it's an exciting time. I think, you know, the next 10 years, I think we'll see a pretty big shift in how humans are able to access the right amount of data to make these decisions that could potentially, you know, shift these, all these environments, healthcare, energy, you know, climate transformation in a really positive direction.
Yeah, it's cool to think that there's some things that need improving in the world. And I think there's some old school ways in which we've gone about it. And I think there's huge opportunity when it comes to data and applying AI. It's really nice to have you on the podcast and have someone that's, you know, from your days working in the Congo to, you know, New Zealand, to being in open heart surgery, to being in Saudi Arabia. Like, you walk the talk. You're there on the ground really trying to understand and learn and then apply your thinking. So really congratulations on all you're doing. We all would be really interested to understand what's next. How do we keep in contact with you? What's the best way to, like, follow your resources or get in contact if people want to understand more from what you're up to?
Yeah, probably the best way is through LinkedIn. So you usually find me under Nicholas King on LinkedIn. So that's probably the easiest way. Well, the website is datakinetic, datakinetic.com. And happy to help folks out, answer any questions. So I think there's a, you know, I'd love to see some of this get picked up in Australia and New Zealand. You know, I think there's a lot of opportunity down there. But yeah, that's the best way. And you know, Dave, appreciate what you and Ali are doing. It's nice to have people out there, like, dive into these stories. And, you know, I've definitely seen a few people your way to sort of carry on the conversation. So
it'll be amazing
for you. Yeah.
Recruiting guests is one of our hardest parts. I think hearing and listening to stories like this just inspires us and everyone. I think it would be amazing actually to get you and a couple of other people on an open live panel somewhere along the way and get all sorts of different people and questions coming from an audience. I just find that super engaging. That'd be so good. Hey, I have one other question before you go. We always ask guests this. You have to finish the sentence. And I also don't even finish the sentence. I didn't even deliver it, and I was already changing my mind on what I'm doing. We never tell people what the question is. So if you've heard one of the podcasts before, maybe you already know, but I don't think you've heard it. So here it goes. AI will.
Look, AI, I think, will augment our lives more than we ever thought beforehand. And so I think that understanding of how much it augments our lives is a choice we will have to make, and one that we should all be very conscious of. And I think those that figure out how to augment their lives best with AI will have a better life. But it's got to be a choice, and it's got to be something that people are conscious of. So that's probably my AI will ...
Fantastic answer. Augment, not replace, not remove, not kill off. It's support, and you're in control is the essence I got from that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not an AI doomsdayer, right? Like, yes, it can be used for bad things, but, you know, my experience so far, it really is a superpower when used correctly, and I think it can really help people. And so, you know, rather than saying let's, you know, ban it from schools or anything else, I think we should be teaching how to, like, you know, train or use that technology and how to, you know, enable people to take advantage of this technology. And it's been around for a long time, right? It's only now it's sort of in the zeitgeist that we're really sort of seeing what's possible. And, you know, we're going to see probably 2 to 3 years of really strong investment here, and then maybe we'll get distracted by something else. But, you know, much like the mobile phone and the internet and everything else before it, those that figured out how to use it first got the most value from it. And that's the, you know, conscious understanding versus just, you know, accepting it and kind of letting it drive you in a direction, I think is really key.
Nice, man. Well said. Been really good to catch up with you again. I want to keep in contact, obviously, naturally. It's nice to connect before the podcast, during this podcast, and after. I want to see what's happening next, where to next. So we'll keep in contact. We'll get this podcast up online for everyone, and connect with Nick on LinkedIn. He said he would open to questions. He's not going to use an AI to reply. He's a very down-to-earth New Zealander. Congrats on all that you're doing, Nick, and look forward to following you further.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Thanks, Ellie. Have a good one. Appreciate it.